Again, I'm Jem.
And I'm Emma.
And it's Emma's first episode, but it's officially the 22nd episode.
Officially first one after the little intro that we did. Obviously didn't make too much of a cock-up as I've been invited back for a second episode. So.
You have. You've been officially hired.
Yeah, that's it. The job is mine. That was like the interview, the first one, and I passed my probation and now I'm fully in the mix.
Yeah, it's just a shame it's not paid. How good would that be?
It is a shame, but
if we could just quit our day jobs.
Yeah, we can dream. when we get international recognition, then we can quit our jobs. And then we can have me and Jem talked about our dream of having a house by the sea and having an army of sausage dogs.
Oh yeah, 10 of them.
Yeah, something previously mentioned in a podcast earlier on in the season, if anyone remembers that, about an army of sausage dogs. So
that is the dream. It is such a dream.
Yeah.
I know, I tell everyone about it. It's like, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. As soon as my kids leave home, this is exactly what I'm doing with my life.
Sausage dog army.
Yeah. Everyone's like, don't you want to get married? No.
No, I just want to have sausage dogs forever. What's wrong with that?
There's a dog in the town I live in, and I swear to God, I see it every day when I leave. And it wears little boots.
Oh my God.
I know.
That's so cute. I can't remember if somebody told me that I was in Pets at Home once, and I saw little dog wellies, and I was going to buy them for my friend's dog. But they said, we've tried this with her before. And it looks like she's tap dancing because she can't wait to get them off her feet. And she's just she's proper freaked out by it. I just think that's almost worth buying them just to see that.
Oh, definitely. I've never had a pet that would wear an outfit. Like our cat now, we put a collar on her a week after we got her. And she threw herself against the wall trying to get it off. So
that's a bit extreme.
I know. So, yeah, we've got no luck. And the kids wanted to dress her up for Halloween. And I'm like, as what? Like, number one, she's an indoor cat. Number two, I think she'd rather die than put anything on.
That is the kind of thing I would have done. When I was a kid, we had this massive ginger cat. He was a stray, but we ended up adopting him. And I bought this little dinner suit thing for him. And all it was it was a type of collar, but it was a collar with a bow tie, a white collar with a bow tie. And then it had little cuffs that went round his paws, buttons on. And he wouldn't wear the cuffs, but he'd wear the collar and he looks proper dapper in it. But I remember I put it on him on Christmas Day thinking, it's Christmas, let's dress him up. It's a nice special day. But then he escapes out the cat flap wearing the dinner suit. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to get reported to the RSPCA. This is animal cruelty. And then an hour later, he came back in with the collar half hanging off as if he'd been on some kind of Christmas bender with his collar all undone. And we were like, I can't believe he's been around the neighbourhood with this dinner suit on. And he's come back still wearing it, kind of. Oh, that's him.
Maybe he walked out with that little collar on and all the female cats were oh, yeah.
Just falling at his feet.
I mean, if he had a top hat on as well. Then that would have been...
Can you imagine? Christmas. Christmas is here, they were thinking. But we digress. This is not a podcast about animals and clothes, surprisingly.
No, but we are talking about something equally as weird. Yeah. Well, maybe weirder.
I'm going to say weirder.
Yeah, it's much, much weirder.
Yeah.
So this week, we are talking about the Manson family. Oh, what a lovely family.
Notorious.
I know. I watched, before I spoke to you, I put a video clip on of Charles Manson. I was like, oh my God, you just give me a headache.
Yeah.
The way he talks. Well, the way he did talk. Spoiler alert. But yeah, oh God.
Messed up, to say the least, I think.
Oh yeah, it's just, ugh. And writing this as well, I think I said it when we released the bonus one. Writing it was just, every day was just chill.
Intense. You never want to hear his name again after this.
No, I mean, I almost cut an X on my own head. But I didn't want to lose my job, so I thought, better not.
Yeah, probably wise.
So, are we ready to dive into this?
Let's get going.
Crazy ride. Okay. On November the 12th, 1934, 16-year-old, which is already problematic for me, Kathleen Manson Bower Cavender gave birth to her son, Charles Miles Maddox, in Cincinnati, Ohio. So, straight off the bat, big Scorpio energy from Charles Manson and me.
So hopefully that's where the similarities stop.
Let's hope so. So when he was born, for the first few weeks, he was known simply as No Name Maddox.
Wow.
I know. Like, his mum just didn't name him.
Jeez.
So that's already, like, a shit start.
Yeah.
But you don't have a name.
Absolutely.
So there's not much known about his father, but he is believed to be a man named Colonel Walker Henderson Scott Sr., although Charles never knew him. When Kathleen told him that she was pregnant, he said he had to go and fight in the war because he was a colonel in the army, although it later surfaced that he was not a colonel at all, and that Colonel was simply his actual name.
Oh, dear.
I know. Who would call their kid Colonel? It's just...
The kind of people that would have a child like Charles Manson, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good shout. So before the birth of Charles, Kathleen married a man named Eugene Manson. And they spent much of their time together going on drinking sprees with Kathleen's brother, Luther, leaving Charles quite frequently with babysitters. Eugene and Kathleen divorced in 1937, and in 1939, Kathleen and Luther were arrested for robbery and assault. Kathleen served 5 years and Luther served 10. During Kathleen's imprisonment, Charles went to live with his aunt and uncle in McMeon, West Virginia. Kathleen was paroled in 1942, and Charles later recalled that the first few weeks after his mother was released were the happiest weeks of his entire life. I know, it's... When I was researching this, I found myself, like, in his early life being like, oh, my God, like, feeling quite sorry for
him. Yeah, because it's so many experiences and so many things that you don't even realise are happening forged in your childhood. And it's it's just really sad what a kind of upbringing he had.
Yeah, definitely. I always think it probably played a massive part in the person that he did become.
Yeah. Well, like so many murderers, serial killers, general wrong-uns, they always have generally a terrible childhood. And it's just, it's so sad that it turns out like that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I just can't imagine. I mean, not everyone has a great childhood, but like when you look at things like this, where you say that the first few weeks when your mother came out of prison were the happiest of your entire life, like that's just, I don't know, I always find it quite sad.
It is.
So after this, the family moved to Charleston, West Virginia, where Charles regularly played truant and his mother spent her time drinking excessively.
Mm-hmm.
Kathleen was arrested again, this time for grand larceny, but she was not convicted. Shortly after this, the family moved again to, this time, Indianapolis. So they're already moving around quite a lot too.
Yeah.
He's still relatively young. So another red flag for your childhood.
Definitely.
Yeah. So we know he didn't have a great start to life, and this is definitely, I think, where his troubles began. Mm. But when he was 9, he said he set fire to a school.
Jeez, a whole school.
A whole school. That seems like I was just talking to you before, like we probably recorded about my job. And I think, oh my God, a 9-year-old setting fire to school.
At least a 9-year-old's not setting fire to your school. I think that's...
Yeah. I mean, give it time. So Charles was also in constant trouble for truancy and petty theft. Charles was eventually placed in the Gibault School for Boys in Terre Haute, Indiana, which was run by Catholic priests. Red flag for me.
Yeah, that doesn't bode well.
No, I think as soon as you see the words Catholic priests,
yeah,
you know, you kind of know where that's going.
Yeah.
So Charles said it was a very strict place and he was punished often by being hit with a wooden paddle. He ran away and slept in the woods or under bridges. In 1947, he went back to his mother's house, but his mother sent him back. And 10 months later, he ran away again, this time back to Indianapolis. His first known robbery was committed at a grocery store. He said he was just looking for something to eat, but it did emerge that he had found money and he did take it. So it wasn't like just this innocent thing. Yeah. Although to me, I don't think that's quite... In the grand scheme of things, it's not a huge crime.
Compared with some of the other stuff he did, I guess not.
Yeah. Like, this is probably the tamest thing he ever did. Easily. So he said he used this money just to rent himself a room because obviously he was living on the streets and in the woods. And he did try and live a normal life and even got himself a job, which was something he had never known. But this did not last long. Charles quickly went back to petty theft. He was caught once more and the judge, being apparently sympathetic, sent him to Boys Town in Omaha. 4 days after his arrival, he and another inmate called Blackie Nelson stole a gun and a car and committed 2 armed robberies on the way to Nielsen's home in Peoria, Illinois.
Wow. So it's a slippery slope. It seems to be escalating quite quickly.
Very, very quickly. But I mean, with the fire at age 9,
it's not the best start. But then it's kind of like, you know, he's learned this from his mum. Arrested for robbery and assault, grand larceny, and you know, it's like,
yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you tend to look at what your parents do in life and try and imitate it slightly, maybe
without even realizing that it's wrong, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I see that in work quite often, but I mean, not on this level,
thankfully.
Definitely not. So 2 weeks later, Charles was caught during a raid at night. He was raped, but oh, where have I gone? Right, we'll have to cut this bit out because now I've... Here we go. Okay, so he was sent to a strict reform school and Charles said this place was a living hell. He was raped by other students in the reform school. Rapes, he said, that were encouraged by staff members. So, and I mean, again, it's where I'm like, oh, I hate this and I feel sorry for him.
He's just getting more and more messed up, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely. So to defend himself from attacks from students and staff, Charles invented something called the Insane Game. And during the Insane Game, he would screech and wail until the attackers left him alone. Yeah, so almost like making yourself look
insane.
Completely insane. So people would just be like, yeah, no thanks.
Wow. Well, that's a horrible thing to even have to think about doing. I'm absolutely not defending him or sympathizing, but just as a child having to like deal with that.
Yeah, definitely. Where it's in your mind to even come
exactly,
up with that.
Exactly, yeah. So he's already like quite messed up at this point.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And he's still like really young. Oh. But in 1951, he managed to escape again. This time, with two boys. They were caught in Utah whilst trying to drive to California in a stolen car. Charles was then sent to another school for boys, this time the National Training School for Boys in Washington, D.C. His aptitude test said he had an IQ of 109, but he was deemed to be aggressively antisocial by a social worker. How do you be aggressively antisocial?
Going out, I don't know, maybe making up things like the insane game.
That's so true.
I guess, he's going out of his way to make people avoid him, I guess.
Yeah, I suppose. Like, I can be quite antisocial, but not like aggressively.
Antisocial.
It depends. Depends on the people. So in October 1951, he was transferred again to Natural Bridge Honor Camp, which was a security institution. He was up for parole and had a hearing set for February 1952. But in January, he was caught raping a boy at knife point. So he was transferred yet again to a federal reformatory in Petersburg, Virginia. This was the point in my research where I stopped feeling sorry for him.
Because he's like, he's just terrible now. And he's gone from like being like this poor child with a terrible upbringing to actually being just an awful, despicable person.
Yeah, definitely. And you'd think as well that because he said that he was raped multiple times by people, to then go out and rape somebody just seems wild to me. Like, you know how that would make you feel.
Something's, he's clearly very, very, very messed up now.
Yeah, I mean, it does get much, much worse as we know. So he was charged with 8 further crimes, 3 of which were called, and I hate this, homosexual acts. Plus, as a crime, apparently. And he was moved to a max security reformatory in Chillicothe. I hope I'm saying that correctly. Ohio. Charles was released in May 1954 and went to live with his aunt. In 1955, Charles met and married a waitress named Rosalie Jean Willis, and they wanted to move to LA together in October of the same year. They attempted to drive by using a stolen car. Normal. But were caught, and Manson was charged once again. He got 5 years probation, but ended up serving 3 years in prison at Terminal Island in San Pedro. During his first year in prison, Rosalie gave birth to their son, who she named Charles Manson Jr. I would not want that name.
You'd just change it, wouldn't you? You would just change it.
I know. I often wonder, like, I did read something, like, briefly about some of his kids. And I was like, oh, God, how would you, like, defend this?
Well, you wouldn't, would you? Just, I always think about that, like, the family members of these people who have done these heinous crimes. And you kind of, like, how would you ever have a normal life after that? Because you're always going to be tarred with that brush of, oh, your dad was Charles Manson, or your brother was Charles Manson. And you'd have to create a completely new identity, wouldn't you?
Oh, 100%. I always like wonder what I'd do if, like, I know this is weird. I wonder what I'd do if a family member of mine went to prison for, like, really bad, like, crimes, like murder. Like, would I stick by them?
That is a question.
I know. I think if it was my kids, I would have to stick by them.
It depends. But I think it really depends on, like, the circumstances, because if it's something where you pretty much know they're guilty, it'd be very hard to stand by them, I think.
But then, yeah. I guess, as a parent, you probably always want to believe that they're innocent. So, yeah, that is a big, big question for a Friday night.
It is. It's a hairy question for Friday night. But there is a like a documentary on BBC Three, just complete sidetrack. I think this lad killed his sister like when she was maybe 5 or 6 and he was maybe about 15, maybe a bit younger. And I don't think he'll ever be released from prison because he is like, yeah, I did it, whatever. It's like no remorse. But his mum still visits him.
It just, I think it's one of those situations where you'd never know unless you're in that situation yourself.
Oh God, well, I hope it never happens.
Yeah, so do I. It's just, I can't imagine. I mean, I can't imagine being a parent myself, to be honest, but having to, one of your children has done that, I just can't. Oh my God, that's just mind blowing.
But anyway, enough heaviness of if our family members become murder people.
I think you're going to find that I will just talk forever and go off on tangents, and these podcasts are going to end up being like 3 hours long because I won't stop filling the time.
That's fine. That's fine. We can just like go off of these random tracks throughout the whole thing. I mean, we started it with cats and costumes, and now we're on. So, what would we do if our family member kills somebody?
These are the questions that the people want to know, they want to answer.
Yeah, these are like absolutely the hot topics going around.
How do you feel about cats and dinner suits? And how do you feel about if your child was a murderer? They are the two questions.
I mean, they go hand in hand.
You know, you dress a cat up in a dinner suit, worrying signs.
Next thing, your child is a murderer.
They are. Anyway, we digress.
Okay. Okay, Rosalie eventually left Charles for another man, and Charles never saw their son. 2 weeks before he was due to be released, he tried to escape by using,
another stolen car.
He was caught and received 5 more years probation, and his parole was denied. It's also important to note that during all of his years in prison, his mother, despite her mothering skills, she moved across the country quite often to be near him when he was in these different institutions. I know, which I always find like quite interesting that she would do that, because she was never really there for him as a child. So.
No, that is interesting.
So here we go. Charles is about to get even worse. In 1958, Charles was making money by pimping out a 16-year-old girl and took her and another girl. So one was named Leona, who he eventually married. He took them to New Mexico to become sex workers, which resulted in a violation of the Mann Act, which was called the White Slave Trafficking Act. It's like, it's 1958 and this was a thing. It's not that long ago.
That's the thing.
Oh, God. Charles was released after being arrested for this, but violated terms of his probation. He was sent back to LA and was ordered to serve a 10-year sentence. Charles was serving his time in the Los Angeles County Jail, but was transferred to US Penitentiary in Washington. In 1963, Leona divorced Charles and said she had his son, another one, who she named Charles Luther. By 1966, Charles was sent back to Terminal Island to get ready for his early release. He had already spent more than half of his 32 years behind bars or in institution at this point. He said it felt like home and requested to stay in prison.
We should have listened to him there, arguably.
Yeah. I think once I got to the end of this research, I was like, this story could have stopped there.
Yeah, absolutely. You clearly have got quite a few problems. Why don't you just stay in prison?
and that would be it. The Manson family would never have happened. But then we wouldn't be doing this podcast right now. So
yeah, exactly. It would have ended there and be like, oh. And then he turned his life around.
He became a model prisoner and yeah. End of story.
I mean that actually could have happened. That's like the crazy thing. He could have turned his life around. I mean, maybe. If they'd have just kept him in prison and been like, yeah, you're really fucked up.
It's almost like it's a little bit of a theory. Maybe he knew he was, like, really bad. And he's like, I think I should stay in prison, like, for the good of everyone else. And maybe he knew.
Yeah.
I didn't know what he was going to do. I don't know if he did, but, like, he knew he was obviously a bit fucked up. So, yeah, we should have... In hindsight, he should have stayed, but he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, I believe he should have stayed. But, I mean, we can't turn back time and keep him locked up. In 1967, he was released and moved to San Francisco to an apartment in Berkeley. It was here that he met library worker Mary Brunner. They soon moved in with each other, where they also lived with 18 other women. I cannot imagine.
I can't imagine living with one other person, never mind 18 other people. No.
I said to someone the other week, like, I don't think I could ever live with an adult.
Yeah, I feel the same. That I first started living by myself quite a few years ago now, but I was really scared because, like, what if I'm lonely? What if I hate it? Yeah, yeah. But now it's got to the point where I'm like, I can never live with anyone again. That's it now. But I've ruined myself.
Yeah, I feel the same. Like,
I can never live with another person, and I'll have to live by myself forever now because I can't. I need my own space. I like my own space.
Yeah, me too. And I feel like I've turned into a selfish person in
that way too. That's a good thing, though. You should be selfish. Selfish with your time and... Selfish with your space. Big believer in
that. Oh, definitely. And selfish with the remote.
Well, that's it. Like, I don't have to fight anyone for anything. And I know if I go to the freezer, there's always ice there in the summer, which is my big bugbear.
Oh, see, my house never has ice in the freezer. I'm so bad. I've bought, like, these ice bags, but they're never in the freezer. And, someone in the house is very unhappy about it. It's Ali. It's just my own laziness. So it's around this time that Charles started parading as a guru in the Hite and Asbury district of San Francisco, which was an area occupied mostly by hippies during the Summer of Love in 1967. Gotta say, San Francisco is one of the best places I've been to.
I had this, you know, I had the big trip that I was going to take last year planned.
Yeah.
And I thought I was going to replan my holiday for this year and travel all down the West Coast, including San Francisco. But I think that's going to have to wait until next year now.
I know. I was really excited for you to go as well because I just wanted to live through you.
But, I mean, obviously had to cancel it, but I'll go. I'll just have to wait a bit longer, I think.
Yeah, yes. Fingers crossed for next year.
I hope things are better next year. Otherwise, we've
got
a few more problems.
Oh, yeah. Just dying for a holiday. So Charles took philosophy from the Process Church of the Final Judgment, who believed that Satan and Christ would reconcile and judge humanity at the end of the world. Okay. This began the formation of the Manson family, which consisted mainly of women who adored Charles. He told his followers that they were the reincarnation of the original Christians and implied, of course, that he was Christ.
Obviously, yep.
Any cult leader, they are Christ. It was also around this time he started calling himself Charles Willis Manson, but he said it slowly to sound like Charles Will is man's son. I'm like, God's sake. I mean, he's not the worst cult leader, but he's like one of the cheesiest.
He's up there, cult surely. He's definitely up there.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Charles and his followers moved to Los Angeles and based themselves in areas such as Topanga Canyon, Malibu, and Venice. So before we go further, let's take a look at some members of the Manson family. I mean, I'm not going to go into every single one because there were, I think, hundreds. But we'll just go through the key ones. So first up, we have Mary Brunner, who I mentioned before. She was born in 1943. She graduated from the University of Wisconsin and was a PhD candidate. She gave birth to Manson's baby in 1968 and named him Valentine Michael. Her aliases in the family were, and I'm going to slaughter the first one. I think it's Marioche, Osh, Mother Mary, Mary Manson, and Linda D. Manson. Next, we have Patricia Krenwinkel, who was born in 1947. Her aliases were Big Patty, Yellow, Marnie Reeves, Katie, and Mary Ann Scott. Patricia said that Manson was the first person to ever call her beautiful. I know. That bit made me really sad.
Like, this is how these like vulnerable people get swept up in this stuff.
Yeah. This is just how men get you.
That's for a different podcast.
Oh, yeah. So next we have Lynette Frome. She was a friend of Patricia's, and this is how Patricia met Manson. Lynette was born in 1948. Her aliases were Squeaky and Red. Manson approached her and picked her up. She was officially the second Manson family member. Lynette gained the name Squeaky later on from the owner of Spahn Ranch, George Spahn. He called her Squeaky, as this was the sound she made whenever he touched her.
That's a nice image.
No, it's really not. Next is Leslie Van Houten.
So, yeah, that's not exactly Milhouse. I was thinking,
no relation.
Was he named after that? Because that, I love Milhouse. And that's, is this going to change my opinion of poor Milhouse? Because that would be a shame.
Maybe she could be like Milhouse's mum because she hurt did Kirk so badly. Yeah. He just wants to borrow a feeling. Maybe that's all Charles Manson wants. Borrow a feeling.
He just needed to be lended a jar of wolf. Anyway.
Yeah. And the race car bed. So Leslie was born in 1949. Her aliases were Luella Alexandria, Leslie Marie Sangston, and Lulu, which is actually one of my nicknames, and I hate that that is a thing. No, my brother calls me Lulu.
To segue back to Milhouse Van Houten,
what's the Simpsons?
So Milhouse's mum was called Luann. What?
Oh my god!
I'm sure like this is not a Simpsons podcast, although that's something we should also do. I'm sure that
absolutely
like, when in that Borrow a Feeling episode when she gets together with that wrestler guy, I'm sure he calls her Lulu.
Yes.
I'm sure he does.
Oh god, he does.
The Manson family. Oh, that's just changed it all. I'm never watching it again.
I don't know if it's made it better or worse. Oh, I'm going to have to look for a clip after this. Okay, next we have Charles Tex.
Bad guy. Watson. Very bad guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
He gives me the creeps, I think, more than Charles Manson sometimes. He was born in 1945. And he joined the Manson family after meeting some of the women. He gained the name Tex because of his Texan accent. Oh, wow.
Inspired.
It's just so great. Wow, iconic. His aliases were, of course, Tex, Charles Montgomery.
Another Simpsons Texas reference Charlie. There. Charles Montgomery Burns. What is happening
oh
here?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. This is, like, honestly the realisation that
based on
the Simpsons is now just... I think it is now. Exactly. I mean, they did predict everything, even though it's happened before. Next, we have Susan Atkins, who was born in 1948. She was living with friends when she met Manson. She found herself homeless after her home was raided, and Manson invited her to live with them. Her alias was Sadie
This
May
is the
Glass.
One I know about, because... Another slight tangent. There's an Alkaline Trio song, one of my favourite bands, called Sadie, and it is about Sadie Mae Glutz and how she was
it
kind
is.
Of so enamoured with Charles Manson that she would have done anything that he said, even if that included killing people, because she was just, she absolutely adored him, so she would have done anything for him.
Yeah. I think a lot of bands have, like, looked at the Manson family and used it for inspiration. Just like our next lady, Linda Kasabian. Nice little segue into that. So she was born in 1949. She was a mother of two who was unhappily married. She decided to join the family when she met some members. Her alias was Linda Christian. I mean, I probably would have just kept Linda Kasabian because Absolutely. That sounds like an alias. Linda Christian is boring. Pick a good alias. Last, we have Stephen Grogan. He was born in 1951. He met the Manson family after his parents dropped him off in Spahn Ranch as they were frustrated with him. He was there to conduct odd jobs, etc. And his aliases, probably the worst ones... Clem Tufts, Grand Mullen, Scramblehead.
Yeah, he's got all these weird Adam names, Gabriel. And then it's like Adam Gabriel just at the end.
Yeah. He just sounds like a film star at the end. Scramblehead, that'd be a good band.
Bet there is one already.
Might have to rename. Oh, yeah, there must be. So these were the main key players in the Manson family and in what would come next, as we already know. And if you don't know...
Keep listening.
Then where have you been? Yeah, definitely keep listening. And where have you been? The Manson family met Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys after he had picked up Patricia Krenwinkel when he was drunk and high on LSD. The next day, he returned home and found Charles on his driveway. Wilson was alarmed and asked Charles if he was going to hurt him. Charles said no and kissed his feet. That is never a way I want
feet
to be greeted.
Feet anyway, so...
Ever.
Yeah, so do I.
Oh, I hate feet. Ugh. So Dennis went inside the house with Manson in tow, where he found 12 strangers, most of which were women. Again, this is my worst nightmare. It's bad enough living with two kids and like three ghosts. So that's just enough. Oh, I saw a ghost last night too, coming up my stairs.
Oh my
God. Like crawling up my stairs.
Why are you telling me this?
I know.
But
you don't live here, you're fine.
I'm alone and I live in a spooky old building. I don't actually live in a spooky old building. It's actually like the least spooky building I've ever lived in. I think I'm pretty
You're
sure
safe,
I'm safe,
don't worry.
From ghosts.
Yeah. So Wilson said years later that he had spoken to Krenwinkel about a yogi that he knew. And she said she had her own guru, and it was Charles Manson.
The fake guru.
The guru. Ugh. Yeah, the Furu.
Nice.
That was probably the best joke I've said
it's
all
time.
Oh, Oh, I don't know. In the house, Wilson allowed the family to stay for a while, where he would play music with Charles, and they treated the women as their servants. Wilson said, I know, it's so gross. Like, ugh. But they happily did it, and that's the thing. Because anything Charles Manson said was the best thing they'd ever heard in their lives. Oh, I just cannot imagine. He just makes me sick. So Wilson said that the stay cost him $100,000. And of that, $20,000 was spent on gonorrhea treatment.
That's just not something you want to hear, really.
It's like every paragraph is like one worse, gross fact. Really? So Dennis Wilson even paid for Charles to record his own music and introduced him to people in the business. These people were Greg Jacobson, Terry Melcher, and Rudy Altobelli. Rudy owned a home that he rented out to none other than actress Sharon Tate and her husband Roman Polanski. It was said that Jacobson was impressed by Manson. I think everybody seemed to be impressed.
Charles Manson, charismatic guy in his way.
Yeah.
Terrifying, really.
God, imagine that now. Yeah. A few months later, Dennis Wilson did not renew his lease on his home, and the landlord eventually evicted the Manson family. So this is where we start to go very, very quickly downhill with the Manson family. Very quickly. It was around this time that they moved to Spahn Ranch, which was a run-down and disused movie set for westerns. The owner, George Spahn, let the family live there rent-free. They lived there rent-free as they not only acted as security for George, who was slowly going blind, but also because Manson said he could have sex with any of the women he wanted pretty much whenever he wanted. Ugh. In around 1968, the family established other headquarters around LA County and Death Valley in other ranches. It was also around this time that Charles and Tex became obsessed with the Beatles, specifically the White Album. Manson was also already obsessed with a race war and said that the tension he had once predicted was also being predicted by the Beatles on their White Album. He even named one of the family's homes Yellow Submarine after the song. It was in this home that the family started preparing for the apocalypse, which Manson named Helter Skelter after the Beatles song. And here are a couple of lines from the song. And if it makes you want to start a race war, I guess let me know your drug dealer, because I don't know what's going on. So here we go. Well, do you, don't you want me to make you? I'm coming down fast, but don't let me break you. Tell me, tell me, tell me your answer. You may be a lover, but you ain't no dancer.
I mean, he's overanalyzing that quite a lot.
I know. I was actually talking to Ali about the Beatles a few weeks ago because she quite likes them. And I was like, do you not know how problematic the lyrics are? Like, some of the songs are just a little bit rapey sometimes. So, yeah, I read all these Beatles lyrics to her. And she was like, oh, okay. So hopefully she stopped listening to the Beatles. Charles began his quest to write and record songs about his impending Helter Skelter, which he said would trigger a race war that would cause tensions, whereby black people would start killing white people and be met with retaliation. Terry Melcher, who he met with Wilson, said he would come over and listen to the songs the family had written, but he never showed up. Charles must have been full of rage. Because on March 23rd, 1969, he showed up at 150. No, I never know how to say these American addresses. Ugh. We'll just say 150. Cielo Drive. As he knew this to be Terry Melcher's address, apparently. But he was wrong, because it was Rudy Altobelli's home that he rented out. I said before that the new tenants were Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski. But he was met with a photographer who was taking photos of Tate before she flew to Rome the next day. The photographer sent him down to the guest house, where he would likely find Altobelli. When he found him, he demanded to see Melcher. Rudy told him that he was not there and gave him a false address to find him. The next day, Rudy accompanied Sharon Tate on her flight to Rome, and she asked him if that creepy-looking guy had been back afterwards. 2 months later, on May 18th, Melcher finally visited the Manson family to hear their music. Not much came from this, and so in June, Manson told the family that it was time to unleash Helter Skelter onto the black community. He plotted with Tex on how he could get some money and said that he should try and rob a black drug dealer named Bernard Crow. So he did. During the attack, Crow said that he would wipe out everyone at Span Ranch, and the family retaliated by shooting him on July 1st. Thankfully, Bernard Crow did survive. I think for a time they thought he was a member of the Black Panthers, because there was something in the news that a Black Panther member had been found dead. So then they started heavily arming Span Ranch, thinking that the Black Panthers were coming there to get them. But it turns out it wasn't him. So on July 25th, 1969, Manson sent Susan Atkins, Mary Brunner, and Bobby Beausoleil to the home of Gary Hinman. Hinman was a music teacher and was also a PhD student at UCLA. He had previously befriended some of the members and let them stay at his home. The plan was to go to his home and demand money from him. They believed that he was very wealthy and held all kinds of investments. Hinman refused, and they held him hostage for 2 days. Manson appeared at his home with a sword and sliced his ear off.
Yeah.
I know, very Reservoir Dogs. Beausoleil stabbed him to death on Manson's instruction, and one of the members wrote, quote, political piggy, on his wall with his blood. They also drew the Black Panther symbol next to it. Beausoleil was arrested on August 6th after being caught driving Hinman's car. They also found the murder weapon. 2 days after the arrest, Manson told the members it was time for Helter Skelter. Again.
Please.
The second run of Helter Skelter. So, yeah. So we've had the attempted killing of Bernard Crow, the murder of Gary Hinman. And now,
yeah, this is where it goes.
It's going to get progressively worse from here. This is where it feels like you're on an actual Helter Skelter going to hell. On August 8th, 1969, Manson instructed Tex, Susan, Linda, and Patricia to go to the house where Melcher used to live and to destroy everyone in there. Manson told them to be as gruesome as they possibly could. In the house, Sharon Tate, who was 8.5 months pregnant, was entertaining friends whilst her husband was out of town. In the home, she had Jay Sebring. I'm going to murder this next name. Wojciech Frykowski. Yeah, we'll go for it. And Abigail Folger. And fun fact, Steve McQueen had also been invited because he'd previously worked with Sharon Tate. But he was busy.
Wise move.
So he had a very lucky escape. Oh my God. So Manson chose this house because he knew the layout. He knew which way would be easiest to gain entry, and he knew Tex knew the layout quite well also. The gang arrived at the home just after midnight on August 9th. Tex climbed a telephone pole and cut all telephone access to the home on Cielo Drive. Then they backed the car further down the drive so that no one would see them. They started to climb a brushy embankment. Then they saw headlights. Tex told the women to get down whilst he stopped the car. In the car was Stephen Parent, a young man who had been visiting a caretaker in the area. Tex showed him his gun and Stephen begged him not to hurt him. Tex attacked him with a knife, which caused defense wounds on Stephen's palms. Tex then shot him 4 times in the abdomen and chest, which pretty much killed him, I would say, instantly. Tex then ordered the women to move his car so that it would not cause suspicion. Now the family were by the home of Sharon Tate again. Tex cut the screen to the window and let himself in. Once inside, he let Susan and Patricia in. Linda was left outside to keep watch by the sounds of it. And in the home, they stumbled on Frykowski, who was sleeping. Tex kicked him in the head, and Frykowski asked, "Who are you? What do you want?" Tex responded, "I am the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business.
Kind of a play on that is in the film The Devil's Rejects. And I didn't know that they kind of cribbed it from one of the Manson family when I first saw that film.
I think, again, like what we said before, I think everyone has just stolen so many things from this entire story because it's just so, so wild. You could make 100 stories out of this one story, which is alarming, really. I mean, this story in itself is bad enough. Susan and Patricia found the other occupants of the home and forced them all into the living room. Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring were bound together by the neck with rope, whilst Tex slung the rest of the rope over the ceiling beams. Sebring pled with the family not to hurt Tate as she was almost about to give birth. But this angered Tex, and so he shot him. I know, it's like, Jesus Christ. And to tie them by the neck too, together, like, Abigail Folger was taken into the bedroom and told to hand over the contents of her purse. All she had was $70. During this time, Tex stabbed Jay Sebring a total of 7 times whilst he was still tied to Tate. Linda, still on the driveway, heard the noises coming from inside and ran inside trying to stop the murders, telling the family members that she thought she heard someone coming. Abigail Folger escaped and Patricia followed her outside. There, she stabbed her, and Tex finished the job. She was stabbed a total of 28 times. I know. Stabbings, like, really get to me. I don't know what it is. I just think it's such a crime.
It's just like
a complete overkill, I think, to stab somebody.
Vile.
Ugh. Yeah. Ugh. Hate it. Frykowski, who had also been shot and stabbed twice, also tried to escape for help, but he was not quick enough, and Tex caught him and killed him by stabbing him 51 times. He had also hit him over the head with his gun 13 times with such force he had bent the barrel of his gun. So I mean, I don't want to know the level of force that is when you would bend a barrel of a gun.
That speaks for itself, really.
Yeah. So in the house, Tate pled for her life, saying they could keep her hostage, but she needed to see her child born. That was all she wanted. This, however, was not enough for the family. Susan and Tex stabbed her 16 times, killing her and her unborn son, who eventually was named Paul Richard Polanski. Manson had instructed the women to leave something, quote, witchy behind. So they wrote pig on the front door in Tate's blood. It's just like, ugh. You kind of read this and think, oh, well, what else could happen? It can't be any worse, but... but it's just, ugh. I hate it, like... Ugh. Okay. So, the day after, Manson told Steve Grogan, Leslie Van Houten, not any affiliation towards Milhouse, Tex, Patricia, Linda, and Susan to go on a drive to find someone else to kill. Manson was annoyed with what had happened the previous evening and decided to go with them to make sure they did a proper job. They had been driving for hours when Manson told Linda to go to 3301 Waverly Drive in Los Feliz. The address was next to a house that they had been to for parties before, and the home was occupied by supermarket executive Leno LaBianca and his wife, Rosemary. Linda and Susan said that Manson disappeared for a while and then returned, saying he had tied up Leno and Rosemary. Although Tex would later say that he entered the house with Manson, where they found the resident sleeping on the sofa. Manson woke him up and Tex tied him up. Manson then told Tex to cover the couple's heads with pillowcases, which they then tied together with cords from lamps in the home. It was around this time that Manson decided to leave, telling Patricia and Leslie to go back into the house and kill the couple. By this time, Rosemary was in the bedroom, and the women had been sent in there with her by Tex. Tex then stabbed Leno with a bayonet, first hitting him in the throat. Watson then heard noises coming from the bedroom. Rosemary was trying to fight the women off. Good for you, Rosemary. Good for you. Definitely. But Tex stabbed her a few times with the bayonet and then returned to the living room to continue attacking Leno. He stabbed him 12 times and carved the word war onto his abdomen. Tex then went back into the bedroom where he saw Patricia stabbing Rosemary. Tex told Leslie that she had to play her part in the killing. So she took a kitchen knife and started attacking Rosemary. She stabbed her 16 times, and evidence later showed that Rosemary had been dead when Leslie attacked her. She had been stabbed 41 times. I know. Oh, I hate. After the attack,
as you do when you just committed multiple murders.
Takes a shower. Yeah, I mean,
use the fertility here. Here.
I killed Why you. Not? I may as well use your hot water. Patricia wrote, "Rise and death to pigs" on the walls in blood. She also wrote "Helter Skelter" on the fridge door. Leno and Rosemary were both dead, but Patricia decided to start stabbing Leno again with a carving fork, which she left in his stomach. And she also stuck a steak knife into his throat. And that is the end of part one. It is. It's like, I think even going into researching this, I didn't realize how insane it was. To the point where I was even dreaming about this at night. Being like, who, like, I think more with the LaBianca murders, just because Rosemary was dead. But oh, let's it's keep just, stabbing her because I have to play my
beyond
part.
Messed up. And Tex is like such an evil shit. Oh my god. Jesus.
I think.
Yep, I was just going to say. Because it's almost
he's
like he's.
Charles Manson.
Yeah, he's acting under the instruction of Manson, but it's like he's just like. He's run with this. Like, he is just evil in and of himself.
Yeah. Definitely. It feels like he wants to be bigger than Charles Manson because he sees that Manson has all these women, like, at his every beck and call, even killing people for him. So I think Tex is then like, well, yeah, you play your part in this now. And yeah. But he never becomes as quote unquote big as Manson. But yeah, it's, I don't know. He's definitely one of the most evil in the whole story for me. Complete. So, if anyone wants to find out what
tune in next time.
You will have to tune in. Tune in next week. I hope nobody was eating, especially with a fork.
Not towards my tea yet. I'm gonna just chill out a little bit and have some tea now. I think of something nice and fluffy.
Oh. Well, as a treat today after work, because I knew I was going to have to talk about this, I got some honeycomb hot cross buns from Aldi. I'm very excited.
Oh, no.
But now they've got the X it's on them, sign. And I'm really not sure if this was a good idea.
Yay.
So,
made it.
Well start done, on your a, first
start
episode.
On a crazy
very
one
exciting.
As well. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. We're going to have to go
we'll
light
do
and
one
fluffy
about
after part two
dressing
of this.
Clothes next week. We'll just expand on that.
Yeah.
We'll do one about
Simpsons references.
Big crimes in The Simpsons. I should totally do that, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Who shot Mr. Burns?
Mafia story. Yes.
Love that.
I watched the Bobo episode the other day and I haven't seen that one for years. I just love when his parents are like, do you want to stay with me, your mother and father, or go with this really rich man? And he just gets in the car and puts the sunglasses on. Let's ride.
Absolutely. I mean, he's another one.
Had his
childhood been more normal, maybe he wouldn't have turned into the evil nuclear power. What's even the word? Tyrant that he is.
Yeah.
One of my favorites.
But oh, what a character.
See My Best.
Oh, such
Absolutely.
Good songs. I mean, See My Best will always be the ultimate banger. So on that note,
yes, indeed,
we ended lightly with The Simpsons. So we will see you all again for part two next week.
And bye from me. Thanks for listening.
It's bye from me. Yeah, definitely. Thanks for listening. Hope no one's been sick. And we will see you.